Last week I dealt in general with general questions of history and historiography. I want to begin this week with a more concrete set of subjects. And I want to do three talks on the question, I suppose you could call it social history, the history of social movements, or you could call it an exercise in the history of mentalities or of political theory. It deals with the problem of politics before, popular politics before the invention of the modern language and institutions of politics. And it also deals with the question of the transition from this old pre-capitalist or pre-bourgeois mode to the present. What I want to talk about this morning is the terrain, if you like, of the kind of popular politics before modern politics came into being. Let me begin with the main characteristics of modern political action. It operates in an institutional framework almost everywhere, which is that of the territorial state, or if you like, the nation state, which has been the political norm since the French Revolution and remains so up to the present. It's virtually universal today. This comprises all the inhabitants of a given territory, other than those which are formally classified as strangers or foreigners. All these inhabitants are counted in their individual capacity as citizens, with a set of rights and duties which, grosso modo, link each citizen directly with the state. The state intervenes directly and increasingly in everyday life. These links are supposed to take priority over all others, at least in politics. In the extreme case, as in war, the duties toward the state are such that you are supposed to get yourself killed for it. This is a thing which you may remember the great philosopher Thomas Hobbes believed was impossible to demand, but modern states habitually demand it. Secondly, modern politics includes or comprises a specific set of tools, an instrumentarium of politics, consisting of ways of organizing and mobilizing groups through parties, unions, pressure groups, media of communication and propaganda, and also of modes of political action, such as elections, congresses, programs, platforms, campaigns, procedures of negotiation, and so on. Now, this box of tools is not only available to anyone who wants to be active in politics, but insofar as it is available, it largely determines the way in which any group pursues its political objects today. Of course, it isn't just available, but it's also been invented and developed for the purposes of dealing with the modern political situation. For instance, mass political parties were developed at a certain stage for this purpose. Anyway, it exists, or it is invented, to cope with the historically specific and the historically novel framework of the modern state, the nation state up to the present. One of the great weaknesses is, of course, that it does not operate outside. All this, so to speak, instrumentarium of politics is largely ineffective, for instance, when it applies to the European community, since it wasn't designed for this. For increasingly, even local and localized politics exists in order to influence statewide or nationwide authorities. That's the essential nature of the politics which most people are thinking of. And thirdly, modern politics includes a specific language of politics and a specific vocabulary and syntax in which politics is discussed, its aims are defined, and so on. For one thing, it is secular and not religious. The rise of religious fundamentalism very recently has changed this, but this is a very modern and contemporary phenomenon. The ideologies are formulated in a historically novel terminology. For instance, in the light of the 18th century revolutions, French and the American revolutions. There are new ways of analysis, of explanation, of conceiving social and political relationships, of processes of change. And indeed, all the terminology we use, constitution, liberalism, socialism, progress, reform, revolution, or, for instance, in Great Britain, mandate, party discipline, ministerial responsibility, all these are historically new and are not part of human nature or human social relations. Now, to understand how the two things differ, let me give the illustration. In the revolution of 1848, the peasants of Moravia conceived which for them it meant the abolition of serfdom. That was the only thing it really meant. They thought the revolution was seen as an arrival at the head of a liberating army of a man called Kossuth, who happened to be the leading Hungarian revolutionary. And Kossuth was seen as the illegitimate son of the emperor liberator Joseph II, who in turn was supposed to be descended from the medieval emperor Sviatopluk. Now, city folk saw the 1848 revolution differently, but that is the way it looked to the peasants in Moravia. The Narodniks in Russia in the 1870s were constantly facing the problem of translating a modern language of politics into a peasant language. For instance, inventing pretenders to the Tsar, you see. They recognized that there was a difference. They couldn't necessarily actually solve this problem. Now, pre-political politics, the politics, as it were, of the pre-bourgeois era, lacks all this, and notably it lacks the national framework, or the national state framework. The wider framework of politics is not absent. In kingdoms and in empires, even the remotest peasant was probably aware that he belonged to a kingdom and he belonged to an empire. But precisely, the ruler was characterized by his remoteness. He had little, if anything, to do with events every day. And this, of course, permitted the construction of the very common myth of the just king or the just emperor, you see, who was a representative of the divine order and the source of justice. And if only he knew injustice here, he would put it right. Everybody knows of the myths of this kind. In the Habsburg Austria, it was the Emperor Joseph II who was supposed to be going around secretly disguised to find out, you know, the Muslim countries was the Emperor Harun al-Rashid, and I mean, no doubt there are other examples and other things. Let me ask one question. There's plenty of precedent for the concept of the just emperor. Is there a concept of the just pope as against an unjust pope? I don't think so, though the question is open. If there is no such thing as a conception of that somehow or other the head of the church is or the Khalif or something is just by nature, if there is no such conception, this would explain why secular revolts were so often conducted in the name of the true king or the true emperor or a man who pretended to be the descendant of the true emperor, you know, against the false king or the false emperor, whereas religio-social revolts formulate a clear ideological challenge. They are heretics or they are schismatics, or they attack the church because it does not represent the real truth of Christianity. Not that the Pope represents the real truth of Christianity, but the bishop doesn't, but the entire church. This seems to me to be a historically interesting decision, but I'm putting this forward as a suggestion rather than real. Do people really believe in the just ruler in medieval or agrarian societies? Probably yes, very often. In the 1970s, there was a belief in northeastern Brazil that there were three people you could trust. One was God, the other was a president of Brazil, any president, by virtue of being the president, and the third was Governor Araiz, who had given social legislation to this area. As it so happened, the president of Brazil had expelled Governor Araiz, who was in exile at the time, but it didn't make any difference. The belief was there. So I think there is some evidence. On the other hand, is there not an element of fiction in this? I think there is. We have studies of a very interesting study called Rebels in the Name of the Tsar of 19th century Russian peasants. There's one example which is quoted. Young peasants in a Russian village want to send a delegation to the Tsar to explain their trouble. But the old men are reticent. Well, they say, who knows whether once you get to St. Petersburg he'll have time to receive you. Maybe he's traveling. Maybe he's ill. Maybe he's in a bad mood. In other words, perhaps it is better not to test the idea that somewhere remote there is a king who is just, you see. On the other hand, there is a real basis for this belief. Suppose you look at the relation between the Spanish colonies and Spanish crown. It very often happened that, Spain being a highly legalistic country, peasant communities in Latin America, in Peru, were in dispute with neighboring haciendas and took the case, and eventually the case reached Madrid, you know. And it is statistically probable that sometimes, at least, the dispute would be solved in favor of the community and not in favor of the hacienda. And to the extent that this is a statistical probability, there is some real basis for the belief that if you go to the very top, the king is just and will, not always, but sometimes. So where the macro state existed, it did form part of the political universe of ordinary people, peasants, townsmen, and so on. However, its intervention in the life of the grassroots was intermittent and irregular, and insofar as it was permanent, it operated through the notables, the local holders of power. These were largely autonomous, but at the same time they acted as the agents of the central state. Example is the Justice in England. The local notables, members of the gentry, landowners, but who at the same time are the local representatives at a certain level of the king's law, you see. Now, these local notables, of course, the local nobles or others, were themselves part of a wider community than the peasants. That's true. The local magnates, the high aristocracy, operated in some respects in terms of the kingdom as a whole. Very little doubt that for a duke or somebody like this, Spain or the kingdom of Castile was a real concept, an operational concept. He had to be consulted by the lesser nobles operated within the region. In England, for instance, when they are still called the county. When people say the county, what they mean is the leading families, land-earning families, not necessarily big nobles, in this particular area. The lesser nobles might also be linked with national affairs through estates or through the diet or something else. But leaving this aside, consider the relations between the common people and the sovereign. There is a tension between the intermittent activities of the sovereign, whether they are beneficial or whether they are not, and the obligations he imposes. Because the king only intervenes, or the state, if you like, intervenes at the time. But the obligations he imposes are regular. Taxes, and possibly calling people up for service. And especially during the transition to the modern territorial state, during the absolutist period, they become more regular. So one of the characteristic functions of pre-political politics is resistance to taxation. Resistance not just to excessive taxation, resistance to all taxation in some sense. Except perhaps to taxation imposed for very precise purposes which make sense. In British medieval history, there is a very common assumption that the king should live of his own. The king has large estates and he should live on the proceeds of these estates, and only in exceptional cases should he demand special taxes and levies on his people, such as when there's a foreign invasion or something like this. I don't know how general this phenomenon is, but the fact is that any regular taxation might seem excessive to a population for whom the activities of the sovereign have no regular relation to everyday life. And especially is this so in the period of the transition to the modern territorial state, when they still don't have much regular relation to everyday life. Today they have, for instance, through social security, but in whatever it is, the early 19th century or something, they probably didn't. And yet, the demands of the territorial state become more regular, more greater, the impact becomes more important. Now, let me make a brief excursus here. What constitutes excessive when we talk of excessive taxation? All common and poor people feel exploited insofar as they were obliged, and they normally were, to give up part of their income, their time, and their labor power for somebody else. Or more precisely, to give them up to people outside the community of which they felt themselves to be beneficiary members. No Dutch peasant, for instance, objected in principle to work which would keep up the dikes, because keeping up the dikes prevents the water from coming into the entire village. Now, part of the transfers from poor people to others are accepted by custom or by institutionalization or by a psychological acceptance of social inequality. Part of these diversions cannot be avoided because they are imposed by superior strength or indeed by the law, for instance, by the social distribution of property rights. Now that part is constantly subject to a silent or overt struggle between classes or between groups, exactly where the limits are of how much should be diverted from the product to other purposes. For instance, in medieval agrarian societies, there is a constant, unbroken, silent struggle for the control of pastures, some of which are claimed by the lords, some of which are claimed by village communities, rival village communities, or individuals. However, part of this diversion is accepted, at least in theory, it is accepted as legitimate, because it represents reciprocity or an exchange of services, which is absolutely fundamental in, it seems to me, the basic structure of social relations. Now, no doubt, this always was an unequal exchange in which men of power use it to justify their excessive wealth and privileges, but it was a real exchange. It is anachronistic and unrealistic to deny that in a system of clientelism or patronage, the client gets some protection or some help from the patron in exchange for his subordination. He does get some, you see. The serf does enjoy some help and protection from the lord. Now, this relation was always asymmetric. It could become entirely unilateral, for instance, when the lord lost the function of actually ensuring the protection and physical security of peasants against raiders or against other lords by means of his armed men. It is also possible that there is no reciprocity at all initially, for instance, when somebody else conquers the land and imposes their superiority. The Church of England in Ireland had no function of this kind with regard to the native Irish population, but only with relation to the occupiers. Nevertheless, what I want to stress is that there are certain transfers from the poor to the rich, from the weak to the strong, which were not seen as illegitimate in principle, but as part of a wider network of reciprocities. Anybody who studied, for instance, things like the Inca society in Peru is very keenly aware of this particular aspect. There is, of course, one big question for research in pre-industrial Europe. Where was this legitimacy accepted and where wasn't it accepted? Is there a difference between different countries in which, as it were, inequality and the existence of privileges among the rich are accepted and where they are not accepted? I am leaving out of account, of course, communities of free poor, such as in the mountains, which do not recognize lords at all. But we are thinking of settled countries with a class structure. Now, I will say no more about the sketchy or shadowy national dimension of politics, and I'll leave out the intermediate scale of politics in order to concentrate on the area which does dominate pre-political politics for ordinary common people or poor people. And that is what the Spaniards call the patria chica, you know, the little world, the small. It's not necessarily only a pueblo. There is an area within which people know each other, have contacts, but in fact, this is an area which is much smaller than a province, a region, let alone the country. In short, except at rare and apocalyptic moments when there's a great and miraculous hope, when the whole world seems to be moving, politics operates in this small, on this small scale. Either it's, if you like, the village plaza or the universe. These are the two poles, you see. There's nothing very much in between. Now, of course, remember that the local area continues to be extremely important even today, when it is clearly subject to, it is clearly dependent on larger areas. If you look at the history of trade unions and the labor movements, for practical purposes, the unit of the trade union is not the automobile industry, and it isn't even General Motors. It is a particular factory in which you are being organized. Now, it's perfectly true that the people who or even who lead the factory have got to bear in mind problems of the firm or the industry or the government or anything else. But you can see this where the local organization is a factory organization with people representing local workers. What really counts and what people really make them up their minds on in everyday life is the experience here in this particular place. So the local and segmented reality continues, though of course today it is very much less important than before. For one thing, mobility is enormously greater, particularly very recently. However, in pre-political politics, this local or segmented reality is omnipresent and virtually uncontrolled. As for the other pole of politics, the universal pole, it's global, it is cosmic, precisely, I think, because the intermediate zones of political action, the macro state, the national state, the kingdom, are so shadowy in real life. The world isn't necessarily global in our sense. It's the world of the cosmic order as it is known. For Christians, it is Christianity, or a particular kind of Christianity. Russian peasants defined themselves as Christians. I know a friend of mine who was translator with the British Army in the Balkans, and when the Red Army came to invade whatever it is, Yugoslavia and Bulgaria, the local sergeants would address the soldiers as saying, "True believers." You know, well, as far as they're concerned, that is, they are part of the Orbis Terrarum, which is that of, in Islam, it is obviously Islam. In China, it is the fact that you were part of the Central Empire, and so on. But observe, there is always a curious dialectic between the village plaza and the cosmos. You see, if the cosmos changes, it is only because simultaneously, I mean, unless the emperor at the top changes, which is another, but otherwise it only changes because simultaneously people come out in every village plaza. That's the only way it can change. This is the basis, if you like, of these occasional millennial movements, which you find certainly in European history, somewhere else too, and the nature of their propagation. They are propagated sideways from one village to another, you see. But of course, when this happens, it is no longer politics. It is in some sense a Hegelian Aufhebung of politics. If by any chance this really should happen and the world should really change, you know, completely and utterly, well, then, of course, none of what exists at present would any longer be valid. To use the biblical term, the lion would lie down with the lamb, you see. Huh? And that is why, under those circumstances, people are very little worried about what exactly the millennium would be like. You find this, of course, in modern terms, in the millennial or utopian spirit of many of the socialist and labor movements in this. The interesting thing about them is how little they ever worried about what socialism was going to be like. I mean, until they actually force a bunch of countries, there's virtually no serious thinking about this business, at least people who think of socialism as a global phenomenon. In the meantime, of course, until the world changes completely, until the days of the apocalypse, human beings must live in a world where lions and lambs do not lie down together, and that is the way they have to remain. Now, let me now turn to two crucial aspects of pre-political institutions. One is devolution of power, decentralization of power, and society conceived not as an aggregate of individuals or even as a territory, but as an aggregate of collectivities, communities, or in the medieval Italian term, universities. As you know, in Italy, our university is known as an università di studi. It is a corporation, a community for studying. It is one of many other types of universities, you see, which is another word for communities and collectively organized, autonomous bodies of people. Now, these communities or universities don't depend on the state of which they form part, even when they are integrated into it. There is a pseudo-problem, for instance, in Russian history, about whether the organized village community, the Mir, existed or whether it was a creation for fiscal purposes of the government, which insisted that taxes should be paid collectively. This is a waste of time. The juridical form of such units may depend on authority and its law, but the reality doesn't. Indian communities in the Andes existed and continue to exist, whatever the legal form in which they were recognized, or even when they were not recognized. They were there. Moreover, devolution of powers and collectivities were two sides of the same coin. The model of the corporation, the universitas, the community, whatever its nature, was the body which sorts out its own affairs and has collective relations with the superior power. And this, in fact, became the model of pre-industrial states in Europe. For instance, a model of feudal states in Europe. Precisely because that model was based on a social reality, and the reality was so structured, even though the state could modify it, and that it was possible to create new kinds of cooperation, which had absolutely no historic precedent, such as, for instance, Università di Studi, which were a new invention, as you might say, but basically the invention of something which is the typical form in which things are organized. Now, this state of affairs had, I think, three consequences of importance for pre-political politics. First, it implied that territorial cohesion was not essential to it. Territory was obviously important for some kinds of community, very notably for agriculturists. I shall return to this in another context. But it is one criterion among many others. What counted basically was a structured group of people. And it was this collectivity of people which was responsible to itself and to the higher authorities. And it had a triple autonomy within variable limits. Firstly, it arranged its internal affairs insofar as these were of no interest to higher authorities, or insofar as it had one autonomy to arrange them against higher authorities. But an example of this kind of autonomy In various South German villages, the married women in a women's assembly used to elect the village midwife. This was their business. It didn't concern anybody else in the village. The men were not involved in general or as social superiors, the lords, nobody else was involved. This was a local women's affair and therefore conducted autonomously by the collectivity of the women. The married women, of course, the other ones not. Secondly, the community arranged its own affairs insofar as the superior authorities, the state or even the lord, simply did not have the machinery to administer them. To put it simply, perhaps too simply, rulers supervise and intervene from time to time, but that's all. They can't do any more. That is certainly the case of the state. The case of the lord is not. The lords were closer, of course, signors. This, of course, explains the enormous looseness of the control, political and legal control, not only that there were very often for the state large numbers of areas which de facto were outside the control of the state, but that there were large bodies of outlaws, bandits, people like this who, for whom no regular method of control existed. But thirdly, autonomy rested on the effective limits which confined the power of the rulers and their power of coercion. Class rule and class domination did not usually and could not mean total despotism. Such cases exist. For instance, I mean, they existed clearly in modern times in German concentration camps. But they are. We must never overestimate the actual power of permanent laws. I don't mean people can come in and raid and rob and destroy and burn down the village and then go away and do something else. We're talking permanent class rule or permanent rule of laws. For instance, it used to be the village community which took the initiative in distributing land among its members. It was not the lord. Of regulating inheritance. Lords had only limited power to expel peasants. And in fact, a German student of medieval village communities says that lords were well advised not to change established custom unless the village considered this an obvious improvement. For, I continue quoting, sudden change put at risk the lord's own income. If you start mucking around with the ways in which the village conducts its affairs, including paying its to lord and to church, then the lord and the church can't guarantee that they're going to get as much out of it as before. In short, the autonomy rested to some extent on a balance of forces. Of course, an uneven balance, but nevertheless, not a unilateral imposition. However, this mingling of an autonomous subaltern system and a system of domination placed one kind of person into a difficult and ambiguous and sometimes impossible position, namely the communal authorities who acted as intermediaries between the two systems. These were responsible both to the lord or the king and to the other members of their community. They could only satisfy the superior authorities with the passive or even the active support of their members. The extreme and murderous example of this kind of intermediary are the Judenräte, the Jewish councils which the Nazis imposed on the Jewish ghettos. The Nazis were particularly keen on medieval archaism. And so, as you know, they made the Jewish ghettos autonomous and put them in charge of autonomous groups of Jews whose business it was, in effect, to decide who should continue to live in the ghetto, who should be delivered up to the Germans. Now, this is, as I say, an extreme laboratory case of something, and there's a great deal of discussion, particularly after the war, exactly on the what was the responsibility of these Jews who took responsibility for their communities, by which they meant they hoped to prolong the life of their communities by being between the Germans and their own community. But, of course, a less extreme case is so-called indirect rule of certain colonial systems. Because of this ambiguity in medieval and pre-bourgeois societies, very often elective and honorary offices in the community, in spite of their prestige, which attracted influential and richer members of the community, were double-edged. Quite often, men had to be forced to occupy these functions because they are both responsible functions and dangerous functions. Even in the 20th century, I gather, there are relics in parts of Switzerland, in the Grison, of some villages where officially the people have to be forced to accept the job of headman of the village, you see. For their position is basically ambiguous. For you see, the local leaders were not simply agents of the rulers. As representatives of their collectivity, it was likely that in normal times they made the best terms they could for the community, which might well be modified and satisfied with the modest results of this modest strategy. But suppose times changed. Suppose the power of the lords was shaken. Then either these local responsible leaders became traitors, quislings, to their community, and were bypassed, or themselves, by force or by initiative, they put themselves at the head of the rebellion. But they didn't know what to do initially, you see, because they were looking both ways. This often happened during the peasant war in Germany in the 16th century. They might even be forced to be official victims and scapegoats. There's a very interesting study by an expert in Japanese history, Irving Scheiner, on Japanese peasant rebellions, which shows that, of course, when there was sufficient unrest in the village, the authorities probably had to make concessions to the discontent when it reached a certain level of open rebellion. But also, at the same time, they would wish to underline the continued authority by punishing someone. And the someone they punished would be the headman of the rebellious village or something like this. This is the dangerous situation in which these intermediary political figures found themselves. My own view is that this produced a double leadership, which you very often see, for instance, in Peruvian peasant risings and occupations of land. Namely, on the one hand, if you get a big invasion de tierras, you have the heads of the community taking part in it. But on the other, there are unofficial leaders, local students, local teachers, or even others. In Japan, I gather, some of these others were marginal people. Bandits, gamblers, footloose artisans, storytellers. Both of these, in a sense, under certain circumstances when politics change. And indeed, it is this unofficial leadership which provides, in some ways, an alternative to or a supplement to the official structure. I'm not claiming that these communities were egalitarian. In fact, rarely, if ever, were they egalitarian. Moreover, with the development of capitalism, the internal social inequalities in communities developed into class conflicts which may or may not destroy the community. For instance, craft guilds clearly began to split at a certain stage. Either they became guilds only of small masters, leaving out the people who were permanently employed, or as in England in the 18th century, they became organizations only of journeymen laborers, and therefore could be transformed into trade unions. So we aren't talking of egalitarian things. I must mention a further distinction which relates to communities but also goes beyond them. And this is a difference between town, between country, and between groups which have no specific localization. The countryside was in principle self-sufficient. I don't mean that it didn't trade and it didn't sell things, but in principle it could live without the town. Theoretically, an agrarian, medieval, or pre-industrial agrarian society could in most cases live without towns, without taxes, without rulers, and without any other kind of superstructure. If they all went away, the village could go on in some way. Hence, essentially, the program of peasant revolutionism is a sort of anarchist millennium. Of course, there always was an external and usually a dominant world. But, as Joel Migdal, a very interesting writer, suggests, in really traditional agrarian societies, the optimum strategy was to keep that world at bay as far as you possibly could. The best thing to do was not to maximize your profits, but to minimize your risks. You see? You couldn't always keep it at bay, but the more you could keep it away from you, the better. So, in some ways, the peasant utopia was not just anarchist, but conservative anarchism, you see. On the other hand, the city could not be self-sufficient. This is the essence about it. The typical expression of this lack of self-sufficiency is the food riot and the unofficial control of prices. The taxation populaire and all this kind of stuff that Edward Thompson and others write about is not a rural phenomenon. It is a phenomenon of small cities, not of villages. There's no need for practical purposes to fix the price of anything in the village except maybe salt or some other things like this. But in a city, yes, you have to. Because the city depends on the food coming from somewhere else outside it. Now, the city, of course, was also the center of administration, even of government. And therefore, from the beginning, the city had a sense of politics way beyond that of the countryside. It could exercise direct, even in the case of capitals, constant organized pressure. And this is one of the things which George Rude and other people discussed in the function of the urban crowd as a constant political factor. And thirdly, of course, the city, in most cases, exploited the countrymen. There was therefore constant tension and hostility, and a lack of understanding in the city of what was happening in the country, which you find even in the ideologies of the 19th century. Marx, Engels, and the 1848 revolution simply did not understand or appreciate what was going on in the countryside until afterwards. There are examples, even today, I have a feeling, for instance, that, I mean, one of the reasons for the appalling development in Cambodia was not merely what you might call Parisian cafe Maoism translated into a system of government, but also, to a very great extent, the hatred of backward peasants for what goes on in cities. The people who were being mobilized by the Khmer Rouge were the backwoods farmers. And what was being destroyed was very largely the population and the civilization of the cities. Take all that away and maybe things are going to be better. Now, this is now a very archaic and obsolescent thing, but it is a factor which continue to have some importance. Less in some countries than in others. I mean, for instance, in China, even though there was an enormous rural predominance, the penetration of things like monetary transactions, trade and so on throughout the Chinese empire was far greater than it would be in some more backward countries. But let's leave it at that. Now, for all these reasons, urban politics were from the beginning far more structured than rural politics, as well as urban institutions. In fact, our modern political vocabulary and institutional vocabulary is based on city politics. It's derived from Greek cities, isn't it? Huh? And the same thing is true of medieval cities. There are perhaps sometimes dangers of anachronism when we look back on medieval cities and see them in terms of modern political vocabulary, because we think of modern political vocabulary as based on the Greek polis. We think maybe medieval towns must have been like that. Perhaps they were. To a great extent they were, but I don't think we must necessarily identify the two. Apart from cities and countryside, there were what you might say national or even international networks. There were national classes, for instance, among the ruling class, which existed, which operated beyond city and countryside. There were even international networks, for instance, of trade. Mostly, I think, in traditional, very traditional medieval agrarian societies, these were composed of foreigners, emigrants and immigrants. Jews, Syrians, Italians, Lombards, and people like this, who occupied a marginal position, didn't fit in, but under capitalism, of course, these marginal extra groups, which you have a interstitial, transitional, are quite easily integrated, at least economically, into the new bourgeoisies. And thirdly, there are popular networks of mobile people, which we must never underestimate. For instance, Joan Scott and myself once did a study of shoemakers as a kind of officio, a kind of trade, which linked city ideas with country ideas, very largely. There are mobile people, there are the constant large group, I don't mean picaros, who were very largely outside the thing, but mobile artisans, or even in agriculture, and in pastoral life. There are people who move around, and this is important. Now, let me finally say a word about institutions. There always was collective action and protest and the demand to regulate relations between groups, including the rich and the poor. Some of these operated through the institutions of the community, through the autonomous corporations and communities, or it was associated with it. For instance, it operated through assemblies and through elections. Some of it was ritualized. There's a great deal of interest at the moment in things like rituals of rebellion or rituals of temporary reversion, like a subversion, like carnivals, which maintain the solidity of the society by periodically, temporarily disturbing it in order to reassert it. However, all these were limited because a great deal of this action was not official, not legal, not recognized, even unofficially. In some ways, a great deal of medieval or pre-industrial politics was like politics in Poland between 1956 and 1980. Everybody knew that there was a working class which had its demands, which organized strikes. Everybody knew that up to a point, if the discontent of this working class got to a certain point, you had to make concessions to it. In fact, very often the concessions were made, for instance, prices were not raised, prices were lowered, and quite in one or two cases, the government had to be changed. And yet, for the whole period between 1956 and the emergence of an organized, formal structure of solidarity, which became an official trade union, an official party, this thing didn't exist. There was no formal recognition. There was merely de facto, you knew you had to operate in those terms, but de jure, you didn't. Now, it seems to me that an enormous amount of pre-political politics operated in this way. You knew there were certain realities. Everybody knew it on both sides. But the realities were not formalized and institutionalized, or they were formalized and institutionalized only to a small extent. And so I come to the conclusion, at least for today's lecture. Politics before the invention of politics was not only different, but also in many ways much more limited in its scope, in its capacity to act, than modern politics. Gramsci, rightly I think, Gramsci was one of very few people who thought very much about this thing in Italian terms. He argued that the subaltern classes in old regimes were, as he put it, I quote, in perpetual effervescence, but as a mass unable to find central expression for their needs. This is true. They could find local expression, they could find here, there, and elsewhere, but not as a general. Okay, but does that mean that this kind of pre-political politics was ineffective? I don't think this is so. It could be highly effective, as I pointed out in the case of the Polish parallel which I drew. If you compare, for instance, the procedure of peasant or popular rebellions which would overthrow Chinese dynasties, say the Ming dynasty in 1640s, and you compare it with a thing like the Chartist movement in England in the 1840s, which was more effective? The Chartists were far more organized, far more conscious, but they actually immediately achieved very little. In the long run, they were not ineffective, but immediately they disappeared from sight. Whereas the Ming dynasty was overthrown by, in effect, the procedures of pre-political politics. And it's particularly important in a country like China, which is the only civilization I know, which constantly bore in mind the institutional importance of this kind of unofficial pre-political politics. When pre-political politics becomes ineffective, is when it starts confronting problems and situations for which it has not been designed. It can be adapted, but there comes a stage when it can no longer be adapted, and it therefore becomes irrelevant to the thing. This is one of the things that I shall consider in other lectures in the next day or two, and tomorrow I shall consider, of course, the objectives and programs for which this pre-political politics operated and how far they were successful. And comentarios y las aclaraciones para ellos que no han comprendido demasiado bien una ponencia en inglés.